Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and call the Senate Committee on Judiciary to order. Thank you for being here. I will note that I do not believe Senator Burdick will be joining us. She is under the weather, and I believe she is trying to get on the mends. With that, we're going to start. We have four public hearings with possible work sessions and then some work session bills. They will do the work sessions later. Because of staff needs and priorities, I'm going to go ahead and start with House Bill 3399A.
John? Chair Przonski, members of the committee, House Bill 3399A comes to you from Representative Nathanson. This requires justice of the peace and municipal court judges to hold a Juris Doctorate degree or to complete a course on courts of special jurisdiction as offered by the National Judicial College, and specifies that judges in courts of records must be members of the Oregon State Bar. Additionally, the measure requires these courts to make and keep audio recordings or transcripts of misdemeanor and felony criminal proceedings for a period of 12 months. We have two amendments today. The proposed A9 amendments remove the allowance for completion of an alternative educational program, and the proposed A10 amendments clarify the required degree. We are also going to have more testimony on this measure tomorrow, so we probably shouldn't work it today.
Yeah, and that's one thing I do want to put on the record. Because of scheduling for individuals, we had agreed to having the public hearing starting today. There will be other people who will be more than likely looking at the check-in list, the opponents, who will be appearing tomorrow. That's something we may want to consider on these bills. You know, we have one day we have the proponents, and the next day the opponents, and they never meet in the middle.
Never meet.
All right. So, Representative Nathanson, why don't you come forward and get us started, and then we'll bring up the other panel after that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Nancy Nathanson, representative from House District 13. This bill establishes a baseline standard for qualifications of local court judges and court procedures to ensure consistent practices with the objective of ensuring equal access to justice across the state. Our state does not have one single unified court system. We have a system of state circuit courts in every county. Local communities also have the authority to set up their own local courts. The latest count in the registry of local courts, according to the Judicial Department, is 181, 146 municipal courts, and 35 justice courts. The Judicial Department manages state courts but has no authority over any local court. The Commission on Judicial Fitness has jurisdiction only over state court judges and justice court judges, that is, justices of the peace. County commissions or administrators and city councils or their managers have administrative relationships with local courts. This proposal sets minimum standards for local courts and their judges only for those courts that handle criminal proceedings. I want to emphasize that. It's not necessarily all local courts. It's courts that are handling criminal proceedings. The bill has two main components. It sets one minimum standard for local courts and another standard for judges. In a nutshell, it requires judges to have some minimal education and for the court to keep a record of a criminal proceeding. That's all. An early draft of a legislative concept related to local courts was circulated months ago, and some of the analysis that had been seen, particularly when this was heard on the House side, was in response to that very early draft and not to the version of the bill that you are seeing in front of you now. Over the past year, I have met with colleagues, with judges from rural Oregon, representatives of the Judicial Department, attorneys, Association of Oregon Counties, League of Oregon Cities, and other stakeholder organizations. I would like to quickly summarize a few key aspects of this bill that make it different from that early draft. It applies only to criminal proceedings, because some local courts handle violations only, like traffic or local ordinances. Those are not sufficient to kick the requirements of this bill. The bill does not require local courts to become courts of record. There's a distinction, and that's a higher standard. The educational requirement says that if the judge is not a lawyer, there is a substitute for that. I have especially appreciated participating in several meetings in the past month or two with judges from Eastern Oregon, and I thank Representative Smith and Judge Chris Perry of Wheeler County for their time. Those meetings have been very helpful in reaching a new streamlined version of the bill, which you see in front of you. It has a significantly narrower scope, and the remaining points were modified in significant ways. The first part of the bill requires justice and municipal courts to keep a transcript or audio record of criminal proceedings for at least 12 months. This is a minimal requirement that can be useful to all parties in making their case should there be an appeal or to resolve a claim of misconduct. It's important to note that this bill does not require local courts to become courts of record. Can't emphasize that enough. I have seen some concern about the cost of this and the cost of purchasing or installing recording equipment. I've seen the number $10,000 suggested. I'd like to address that very specifically. That appears to be based on a system that has been installed in a local court of record. Our research indicates that recording equipment is commonly available for around $1,000, often a little less than that. For example, a smaller court can purchase an all-inclusive Philips two-channel four-microphone system for just $850. For a larger court, you could instead buy a four-channel recorder, a Roland R44, for around $800, depending on where you buy it. If you want additional microphones, cable adapters, extensions, and SD memory cards, the total cost comes to around $1,300. That's for like the full meal deal. These are only two options. A low-cost, simple one for a smaller court is certainly going to cost less than the $10,000 that I've seen in some statements. Judge Perry has provided an even much lower cost example that he has already successfully implemented in Wheeler County. It's under $100 a year. That equipment is suitable for a simple recording of proceedings to capture the statements that are made in court. Now I'd like to talk for just a minute about the educational requirement for educational standards for newly elected or appointed judges. Currently, under Oregon state law, you do not have to have a law degree, pass the bar exam, be a member of the Bar Association, to be a judge in a justice or municipal court. In other words, there is no minimal educational requirement for judges once they start trying criminal cases. The qualifications of individuals serving as judges in local courts vary from one place to another. Municipal court judges or justices of the peace are not necessarily required to be trained in the law. Of 12 lay justices of the peace, we know of 9 that have already completed the course available from the National Judicial College that's mentioned in this bill. But only 4 of those had completed it within the first year of presiding as a judge. All justices of the peace attend a continuing legal education program accredited by the Oregon State Bar, meeting requirement for all judges, both lay and lawyer judges. That's 30 hours of legal education every 2 years. But again, that's after they've already been presiding over criminal cases, perhaps for up to nearly 2 years. This bill requires new judges to have a law degree or complete the National Judicial College course on courts of special jurisdiction within 12 months of being elected or appointed. This course provides valuable information on topics such as courtroom procedures, making evidentiary rulings, handling cases with self-represented litigants, and creating a sense of impartiality and fairness in the courtroom. The National Judicial College has 2 types of scholarships available, again, to address the potential cost concerns. One is a $1,000 federally funded award from the State Justice Institute, and another is up to $500 from the NJC. The bill also provides an extension of time to complete the educational requirement should some unexpected exigent circumstance prevent the new judge from completing the course. A judge may request a one-time additional 12-month extension from the presiding judge of the judicial district. Oregonians' impressions of justice are formed in part by their experience in court. And Oregonians don't make a distinction from one court to another, whether it's a local court or a state court or a court of record. In Oregon, and indeed across America, the public is asking for transparency in all aspects of our government, whether it's contracts or cost efficiency, or the criminal justice system. This bill moves us forward in increasing public trust in our system of justice. I ask for your support this week to establish these two minimum standards to raise the bar for justice and increase confidence in courts statewide. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for the representative?
Well, how you mentioned scholarships. You mentioned scholarships. How much is the course?
I'm Mr. Chair and Senator, I'm sorry, I don't have the cost in front of me. It's a cost, though, that apparently has been affordable already to 9 of our 12 lay judges in justice courts.
And I didn't catch how long it takes if somebody was, I mean, how can you take, is it online? I didn't catch all of it. You were kind of going through it quickly.
Mr. Chair and Senator Thatcher, the course is under 2 weeks.
Okay.
It's not nearly the same as attending law school and getting a degree. It's a, I guess you would say, a rather short course. It's an in-person course, and I've seen the list of all the seminars and breakout sessions that you attend.
If I remember correctly, it's in Nevada. I can't remember if it's in Vegas or Reno.
Reno.
Yeah, and it's traditional. I mean, that's where most new judges go. We'll go through that to kind of get the nuts and bolts of running a courtroom.
And that is the only option? There's no other options out there?
I believe that there's probably something on the East Coast, but that's the one I'm familiar with. That seems like the individuals who are serving on the bench will go to. It's one in Reno. There may be others, but that's the one I'm familiar with. Other questions? Representative, thank you very much.
Thank you.
So I have three other people who were on the witness list for today, John Henry, Gail Meyer, and Lee Berger. Why don't the three of you please come forward? And while they're coming up, I'd like to know if there's anyone else who will want to give testimony today on 3399A.
Let's go first.
Good morning.
Good morning. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. OCDLA lends its hearty support for House Bill 3399, and thanks Representative Nathanson for bringing the bill. It's an important bill, and one that we were very delighted to see when it, as introduced and also as it's before you today. I'll speak twofold with respect, firstly, to the qualification for the judicial officers that preside over these proceedings. We have a listserv where I'm able to send out queries to members and say, okay, what do you guys think about this? Uniformly, what I heard back for people who have consistent practice before these courts say that, you know, it comes in both ways. There's a lot of folksy, community-based justice that can be disseminated in a justice court or municipal court, and it's based on local community norms, and a lot of time it's very restorative and pro-social rather than punitive. But also at the same time, in others, you can have a lot of erroneous and random justice, particularly when it comes to matters of rulings on matters of evidence and also on legal challenges for matters of procedure and legal interpretation of statutes. This is where I heard the biggest complaints. So anything that can be done to elevate the qualifications of those judicial officers will be a very good thing, in our view, in terms of improving the distribution of justice in those courts. I recognize the bill, when it comes to recording, only applies to criminal proceedings. But by elevating the qualifications of the jurists, of the judges there, it's going to help everyone that comes before those courts. One person was pointing out that they represent persons who are professional drivers. So we're talking about truckers, we're talking about limo drivers, taxi drivers. For them, even one single little ticket can be of huge consequence in the course of their business and their career. So elevating the qualification of the judicial officers is very much an important thing. With respect to the recording, there's other practitioners here who will tell you their own stories, but the thing that I consistently was hearing from membership is there seems to be a hostile environment from some of these judges when there is an effort made to make a record. So this is at the party's own expense, but there seems to be a lot of hostility to the thought that someone would bring in their own reporter, their own transcriptionist, their own recording device, and for reasons that really isn't, it's hard to flesh out. What's the problem with putting the record on and making sure that these proceedings are open? All the testimony that's given in these courts is under oath, subject to perjury, and yet there's no record. So we definitely support House Bill 3399, and happy to answer any questions.
All right, thank you. Who'd like to go next?
Oh, I'm terrified of following John Henry, so I'd like to go next if I could.
I'll pay you later.
I knew who the closer was going to be anyway.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Leland Berger. I live and work in inner northeast Portland in Senator Shields and Representative Frederick's district. My practice is statewide. I represent medical cannabis patients and their providers, and I also advise emerging cannabis and medical cannabis businesses at Oregon Cannabis Compliance Council, LLC. One thing I like about the bill, of course, is that there isn't any local option, that it would be applied statewide, and there's no issue about what would happen if somebody wanted to opt out. I also reviewed the other testimony that had been provided in writing. I join in Mark Gorski's letter that he submitted today. And I noted that a judge wrote in an issue about the way that it's spelled out what your degree needs to be, and I assume that the amendment addresses that and would encourage the committee to adopt that. My practice is not primarily in municipal and justice courts, but my experience is there have to do with less than an ounce tickets and driving under the influence of cannabis. Unfortunately, effective July 1st, there won't be any more possession of less than an ounce tickets, except for the drug war victims who are between 18 and 21 years old. And my experience is consistent with what Ms. Meyer described as the feedback that she received. Sometimes it's really helpful, particularly in violation matters, to have a folksy person. And I think also that my experience has been that they're well trained for what appears on the violation matters to be their principal function, which is to get the fine right. One thing about the criminal law, including violation law, is that the more people that can be affected by a law, oftentimes the more complex it is. It's certainly true for driving under the influence law, and we in the criminal defense bar are especially blessed to have Mr. Hinkson, who is always more than gracious with his time whenever there's a lawyer in need of some assistance on those cases. But I have experienced seeking recordation and offering to pay for it and it being denied out of hand. And I've also participated in proceedings in municipal and justice courts around the state in Burns, in Klatskanai, elsewhere, where the proceedings were, you know, less than fair. And that while there is the remedy of a de novo appeal to the circuit court, my clients typically are folks who are not very wealthy, except for some of the business clients. But the people that show up in municipal court, who just because they're able to hire a lawyer doesn't mean that it's not a hardship for them to have to try the case twice. And I think that if and I wanted to thank Representative Nathanson for introducing this, but if you move this to the floor with a due pass so that we can join with the House and move this bill forward, that it'll improve the quality of justice statewide at justice and municipal courts. And I thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. John Henry.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is John Henry Hinkson III. I'm a criminal defense lawyer with my office in Oregon City, where I've been practicing since 1971. I've tried cases throughout the state of Oregon in justice courts, municipal courts, circuit courts, and the old district courts. And I'd like to specifically hone in on the issue of this recordation issue. And I've got a couple of stories I want to share with you that I bring from east of the mountains. About 35 years or so ago, I traveled to a eastern Oregon county for a trial. And while I was waiting for the proceedings to begin, I saw the sheriff bring in a Native American in handcuffs. He was charged with rape in the first degree, a Class A felony with a maximum punishment of 20 years in prison. At the time, the district court where I was not a court of record. So there was no recording, there was no court reporter, there was no tape recording going on at all. And this Native American was addressed by the district judge and said, who said to him, I'm going to read you the name, your name and the charge against you. And he did it. And then he said, do you understand? And the defendant said, I would like to speak to a lawyer before I respond. And the judge said, I'm going to say it again. This is the charge against you. Do you understand? And he said, Your Honor, I request to speak to a lawyer before I answer. And the judge, exasperated, said, I am going to tell you one more time. The charge against you is such and such. Do you understand? And he said, Your Honor, I'm sorry. I must speak with a lawyer before I respond. And the judge's response was, Sheriff, take him into custody and back to the jail. I find you in contempt of court. Fast forward to last year in that same venue in a municipal court. I was defending a physician on a charge of driving under the influence of intoxicants. The case was scheduled for a jury trial. I filed a formal motion to allow me, at my expense, to bring in a court reporter to make a record of the proceedings. The motion was denied. In an explanation as to why it was denied, the judge said, we never did it before. And this was a judge who was new to the job, and the predecessor judge had been in that position for over two decades. I said to the judge, we've never done it before, really doesn't address the issue. I remember, Your Honor, back in the 50s, where a little child knocked on the door of a school in Topeka, Kansas, and said, I want to come inside, and I want to get an education. And the little child named Brown was not able to be admitted because of brown skin. And I said, the members of the Board of Education of Topeka probably said it's never been done before. But that doesn't respond to the question of whether this is justice. Unmoved, the judge said, your motion is still denied. And I said, in the alternative, I asked for authority from the court to put down a digital tape recorder to record the proceedings. That was likewise denied. The case proceeded to trial, and it resulted in a mistrial as a result of some conduct by the prosecutor. The case was rescheduled for trial, and now what I was in the position of, with the police officers having committed themselves to a story, I was now deprived of what John Henry Wigmore called the greatest engine in the search for truth, cross-examination, because I didn't have a record of the proceedings that I could use to impeach the testimony of the police officers who changed their tune. I should add that the judge said to me at the beginning, well, you can bring your somebody over here to write notes about what happened. And I did that. But when we showed up for trial, the judge's clerk, seeing my legal assistant with me with a laptop, said, you can't record this. You cannot record this. while the judge was in chambers, and the judge came out, and I said, Your Honor, you denied my motion to have a court reporter here. You denied my motion to allow me to have a digital tape recorder here to record the proceedings. You told me that I could have an assistant come in here and record by writing down what people said. And now your clerk has ordered her that she can't even do that. And he says, well, I'll overrule that and allow her to type it up. And very quickly, in a way that was not very efficient, we did have a record. But as the case proceeded on a motion for dismissal based upon double jeopardy, the prosecutor, in my recitation of the facts, referred to me to the judge as a liar. I didn't have a record to defend the truthfulness of what I had said. I was deprived of the truth. My father, I must confess, was a Southern Baptist minister with roots in the red soils of Alabama. But I, whether you're a believer or a non-believer, believe in the wisdom of John 8:32. And by the way, it's also emblazoned in marble above the Texas Tower in Austin. Giga Maggies and Hook'em Horns. And what is there is this wisdom. You shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. I say to you that this bill is an advancement in the search for truth, consistent with the wisdom of folks long since dead, including my namesake, John Henry Wigmore. So with that, I want to say to you, when I saw this bill that was drafted without my communication in any way, shape, or form with Representative Nathanson, I told her in the hall, I just christened her as Mother Teresa.
John Henry, thank you very much. Any questions for the panel? Thank you all very much for coming forward. So this is going to conclude the public testimony for today on House Bill 3399A. We are scheduled, and it will continue tomorrow with another panel or panels coming in that we've agreed to set over for scheduling purposes. So we'll conclude today's public hearing on 3399A, and it will continue tomorrow. And we're going to 3347. And so we're going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on House Bill 3347A.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, House Bill 3347A comes to this committee from Representative Hoyle. The bill has no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact. It passed out of the House. The bill amends the definition of person with mental illness for purposes of civil commitment. Specifically, the bill expands the statutory definition of person with mental illness to include people who, because of a mental illness, are unable to meet basic needs that are necessary to avoid serious physical injury in the near future. The bill is ready to move.
All right, thank you. Representative Hoyle, I know you're here on this bill, so why don't we get your testimony.
Good morning. Val Hoyle, House District 14, West Regina, Junction City. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, thank you very much for hearing this bill this morning. This bill making a slight change to the civil commitment statute passed unanimously out of the House Health Care Committee and unanimously off the floor of the House. It makes a slight change to the civil commitment to the statute that says when people can be civilly committed. Now, it's very, very important that we protect people's civil liberties, but also that we protect people who are vulnerable and most at need. What this does is puts a small sentence in that says if someone is unable to provide for their basic personal needs, had already been in the statute, and this adds, that are necessary to avoid serious physical harm in the near future, and are not receiving such care as necessary to avoid such harm. The reason that we brought this forward is that we had a woman in Lane County, and over in January, there were a number of us that were working to protect her. She was living in a tent. She was psychotic. It was urine and feces soaked. She was afraid to go into a shelter because she thought she was being attacked. She was not actively suicidal, and so our county, because of different court law, did not feel like they had the ability to commit her to a safer place. We were able to get her into the hospital because of some physical issues, but she was only kept a few days. And our police chief said he thought that if she stayed the night out there, it was 15 degrees outside, that she would die. But because she wasn't actively suicidal in Lane County, she was not qualified to be civilly committed. Had she been in a different county or a different place, they may have interpreted the law differently. So this slight change just ensures that people throughout the state can have the same kind of treatment, and we can protect those people who are most vulnerable. The bill was crafted with the help of key stakeholders, including Bob Jundup, Disability Rights Oregon, Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. They improved the bill considerably. It was much broader initially and now is quite narrow. I would encourage you to vote yes. It's actually a very small but important change.
All right, thank you. Any questions for the representative? Val, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I have three individuals that have signed up, and the first person I got, Jack A. Hacha. Sorry, sir. Thank you very much. Bob, why don't you come on up, and then Scott Winkle. While they're coming up, let me see if there's anyone else that wants to give testimony today on House Bill 3347A. Okay. Gentlemen, thank you all very much for being here. Whoever would like to start off.
Okay. Good morning. my name is Jack Hoschuk. I'm a retired psychologist who provided forensic clinical services at Oregon State Hospital for 19 years and also administered community mental health programs spanning another 19 years in Oregon and three additional states. And additionally, pertinent to this particular issue, in four states, I also was instrumental in implementing civil commitment laws as well as overseeing program implementation of such laws in different types of jurisdictions. House Bill 3347 proposes modifications of the civil commitment statute to reduce incidents of citizen harm toward themselves or others due to seriously diminished functioning secondary to severe symptoms of mental illness. Much thoughtful and heartfelt testimony has been provided to underscore the rationale for this suggested modification. The proposed language modifications would expand the time framework for estimating a person's likelihood of doing such harm and redefine the qualification for providing their basic needs that are necessary to avoid serious physical harm in the near future and is not receiving such care as is necessary to avoid such harm. On the surface, the proposed modification seems reasonable for preventing danger to all individuals involved. While there might be some advantages to implementing the proposed modifications, there are trade-offs made that are not so readily seen, and these trade-offs actually stand to make the intended improvements in safety harder to achieve. We must check our intentions for a moment and step back to consider the unintended consequences of such modifications. Number one, the primary reason that mental health crises of the nature targeted in our civil commitment law progress to an emergent status is due to the lack of availability of proven and effective restrictive and less restrictive services in the community. Such services, such as acute residential crisis services and peer respite services, have been shown in studies and in practice to be attractive to individuals in crisis and provide the framework needed to obviate the potential dangers to the individual. Not only does this bill do nothing to provide these less costly and effective alternatives to hospital commitment, but the bill does nothing to change the reality that a citizen no longer has a voluntary hospitalization option available in the vast majority of mental health crises. Hospital bed space is reserved for the inevitable involuntary commitment circumstances produced by the lack of earlier and less restrictive intervention services. There was a time when individuals could voluntarily avail themselves of hospital-level relief and safety when they experienced serious declines in their functioning in advance of imminent danger to themselves or others, and they did. Over the course of my career, I saw that many times. I have heard many times here in this state individuals say to me, I wish I could just go to the hospital, but they turn me away because I have to be involuntarily committed these days. There's no beds for me to be able to go and get respite. And I would do it right now if I could. And as already mentioned, there is now available equally effective community service crisis alternatives which could affordably be implemented in lieu of costly hospitalization. An unfortunate byproduct of this bill will be an increase in the use of dehumanizing involuntary detention processes in place increasing the availability of humane and initiative supporting community alternatives for seeking safety and healing in a mental health crisis. Number two, the result of expanding the criteria for those qualifying as requiring civil commitment, no longer just those imminently in danger, but now also those estimated to possibly be in danger sometime in the near future. In the near future, undefined. To an evaluator, that is just bizarre because you can have this be interpreted so many ways. Will be to cause an increase in court activity and be the needed costly capacity of courts to process the increased incidence of civil commitment adjudication. The increased incidence of civil commitment processing will either significantly burden the current court capacity, or counties will have to increase their court expenditures to increase that capacity. Number three, another result of expanding the civil commitment criteria will be the need for increased costly emergency department and hospital bed capacity. More individuals being detained, evaluated, and treated within our current service structure will increase hospital and payer costs significantly. The number of hospital beds will need to be increased, and the number of staff needed to provide services will increase accordingly. Number four, several individuals providing testimony in the House testimony in support of House Bill 3347 talked with hope and expectation that increased detention of individuals suspected to be dangerous sometime in the near future would finally provide a framework for referral to appropriate services. Yet there is nothing in this bill by which aftercare services will be increased and become available. Our mental health system is already stretched, let alone able to provide for an increased number of individuals needing services post-discharge. Number five, many more individuals who would not become dangerous in the near future will be detained and subjected to involuntary processes as the natural outcome of expanding the length of time within which a person would be estimated to become so dysfunctional and dangerous to themselves and others. The predictive validity for estimating the current imminent temporal risk factor is poor. Poor predictive validity when this is tested according to research. And as the length of time being used now to be in the near future, in which to predict is lengthened, the predictive validity decreases even further, and more individuals who would not have become so dysfunctional and dangerous will be erroneously detained. In other words, the proportion of false positives. Individuals who are estimated to, oh, you're going to be become so dangerous in the near future, whenever that is, that we're going to involuntarily detain you now, that proportion is going to increase just because we have increased the time framework and decreased the predictive validity. Number six, and finally, Oregon is being monitored by the United States Department of Justice for compliance with the United States Supreme Court's Olmstead decision, which requires that individuals be treated for mental health needs in the least restrictive environment. Oregon has received mixed feedback at best about their current efforts to reduce the number of individuals cared for in restrictive hospital and community treatment environments and has much work to do to comply with USDOJ directives. By increasing the number of individuals hospitalized under this expanded civil commitment criterion, HB 3347, and allowing the current level of community services to remain unchanged, Oregon will become even further out of compliance with the requirements of Olmstead and the USDOJ. Oregon does not want to invite being perceived as being oblivious to the requirements of Olmstead. Thank you for considering these points. I strongly urge the rejection of House Bill 3347 and a reconsideration of strategies by which equally effective services can be provided to implement humane, safe, and cost-effective options for crisis intervention. Thank you.
Jack, let me just ask, have you submitted your written testimony to the committee?
I provide a number of copies here.
Okay, fine. I just want to make sure that goes on the old list.
Thank you.
All right. Who's next?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bob Junda from Disability Rights Oregon. First of all, I'd like to thank Representative Hoyle, who reached out to us after the initial bill was introduced in order to discuss what types of changes might address her concerns. As you heard her testify today, she'd experienced the situation in which there is a woman living in a tent who was quite disorganized and about whom she was told by a law enforcement officer that the woman would die that night if she were to sleep outside in the cold. According to her testimony and what she's told me, that the local authorities did not find that to be sufficient cause to initiate a civil commitment hearing. So the question posed for us is that, does the standard that we presently have cover that type of situation or not? My own experience is that the standards of the civil commitment criteria, particularly this basic needs standard, is applied very differently in different counties by different judges. It's a vague provision, and it has been interpreted by our courts in very specific circumstances. And then those interpretations by our courts have then been applied in jurisdictions in different ways. So the question posed to us was, is there a way to clarify this language so that it can be more precise to capture, if you will, the type of situation that Representative Hoyle was mentioning? And that's where the language that you had before you came from. It was an attempt to look at a situation like the type she set forth and to come up with some language that might capture that situation without essentially broadening out the commitment criteria. Now, why would we be concerned about broadening it out? Well, you've heard testimony already about some of the problems with broadening those criteria. First of all, there are civil rights concerns that people's freedom not be taken away unnecessarily, particularly if they choose lifestyles that we might not prefer for ourselves or our family members. But also, Oregon does deal with some resource issues. In the mental health area, we essentially take a pot of money and then we divide it between our state hospital system and our community mental health system. Over the years, I don't think there's any secret that our community mental health system has been significantly underfunded. And when it is significantly underfunded, that means that people who can receive outreach, supports, housing, and mental health treatment don't receive those services. they can go into crisis that can land them either in the criminal justice system or in our civil commitment system and ultimately to the state hospital. So we as you as policymakers have to make decisions about how to allocate those resources effectively. We would suggest that it is more humane and more efficient to bundle your resources into the community rather than putting them on the back end where we see the failures of community treatment. It just so happens that right now representatives of the U.S. Department of Justice are meeting with state officials to discuss their investigation of Oregon's mental health system. You heard the word Olmstead. That is the provision of the Americans with Disabilities Act that says that when the state provides services to individuals with disabilities, that it should not provide them in settings that are unnecessarily segregated. And the contention of the Department of Justice has been that the way Oregon has chosen to fund services, in other words, making that decision, how much money to put into the state hospital, how much money to put into community services, has been skewed in favor of the state hospital and needs to shift. And the legislature has stepped up, particularly in 2013, with some additional resources for crisis services in the community to try to address that imbalance. This is going to be an issue that's before you in the month ahead what I would suggest to double down on that effort to minimize the impact that our present system has on the state hospital. So for those reasons, Disability Rights Oregon is, in fact, neutral on this bill because we feel that how this standard is actually applied will depend upon how it is interpreted by local jurisdictions and how it is interpreted by our appeals courts. We don't know what that is. You know that whenever you change the language in any law, that the courts then get another slice at it to see what they think it says. In our estimation, it does not broaden the commitment standard. It merely tries to clarify it, but that's, of course, our opinion. Thank you.
Thank you. Scott?
Thank you. Chair Przyjanski, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Scott Winkles, and I represent the League of Oregon Cities, and we are appearing in support of this bill. For the first time, to my knowledge, in the League's history, we've prioritized and engaged actively on mental health issues around the state, and the reason we've done so is that the mental health system in the state has deteriorated to the point where it's police officers, it's the 911 call, whereas the first time that we intervene in somebody who's in crisis, and it's costing in lives and in dollars to local governments. I want to relay to you a specific incident that occurred recently in the city of Astoria. A woman by the name of Carrie Barnhart, who was 54 years old, was found walking across the Astoria, the bridge that connects Oregon and Washington. This woman was known to be suicidal by the Astoria Police Department. The Astoria Police Department talked her off the bridge and brought her for an assessment by the community health contractor for the agents for Clatsop County. Carrie was released 2 hours later. The police department was asked to come back, pick her up, and return her home. A week later, she was found at the base of the bridge. She had completed her suicide. This is an individual who had warned that this was what she intended to do. There was, I think, that her ability to comply with the treatment plan was not there. I think the police department involved in my conversations with the reporter who had been researching this issue, and my understanding of the media reports was that this is something that she'd intended to do for some time. We believe this legislation could have impacted this outcome. Additionally, the situation Eugene that was described by Representative Hoyle, we're talking about this individual had also committed an act of reckless burning in an attempt in believing that she was under attack, had lit a temporary abode that she was staying in on fire, believing that she was to protect herself. Clearly the system, yes, the league agrees we are not spending our money in the right places. We do need more assistance. We do need more respite care. The city of in Astoria and Clatsop County, the community is galvanized around forming a respite center, a 16-bed respite center. But we don't believe that the current statute is sufficient to protect this vulnerable population, and we would urge the passage of this legislation moving forward.
Thank you. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, Gail Meyer, on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, we are in support of House Bill 3347 as it's appearing before you in the A engrossed version. As it was originally introduced, it was broader, and it did invoke our concerns. Our members, by the way, are by contract assigned to do civil commitments in all the 36 different counties. But we met with the practitioner who does the bulk of the civil commitment proceedings in Multnomah County, met with Representative Hoyle. And that practitioner was pretty confused as to why a Lane County judge would not have committed this individual, whom was the constituent of Representative Hoyle. And I would endorse the comments made by Mr. Junduff. It appears as though these rulings are disparate county to county to county. Everybody interprets them differently. The intent here from this practitioner was to really take more defining language that's already existent in Court of Appeals decisions and codify it into the statute. So rather than creating a new category, there's no new category here, it's the same category, person with mental illness, it simply gives more clarifying language, and it inserts that temporal requirement in the near future that is already discussed in the Court of Appeals decisions. And so from the vantage point of OCDLA, this is an attempt to clarify existing statute or Court of Appeals interpretations rather than to necessarily create new ground. We would endorse the comments made by the prior speakers here about the need for greater emphasis and infusion of resources into community-based services, but in all, we support the engrossed version of House Bill 3347.
All right, thank you. Questions for anyone on the panel? Well, Senator Thatcher.
I would like your response. Is it Jack?
Yes, Jack.
Thank you. Okay, so this scenario of this lady who is going to, she was on the bridge, known to be suicidal, and was taken into custody, interviewed by a contract mental health specialist, released, and then committed suicide 2 weeks later. Does that, do you think that would just be an exception to the rule? Do you think that would not be helpful to people, having this law in place?
What I testified to would have possibly, and I think likely, have precluded the outcome that finally transpired. The outcome actually was that the individual went voluntarily, was not committed. How that occurred was by the assembly of some peer specialists and other individuals who were not previously pulled together to intervene with this woman. And had that occurred earlier in the process, while the individual was perhaps more lucid, cogent, the likelihood, we could estimate that the likelihood of her cooperating, as she ultimately did earlier on, would have been improved. Also, then there's the clear issue of how terminology gets interpreted by different jurisdictions. To me, in the near future, is not a clarifying process. It really creates even more vague language. Imminent was much clearer than sometime in the near future. Thank you.
Anything else?
No, just an interesting.
Who's that?
Okay.
No, right. I think that's clear.
Okay.
Thank you. All right. Thank you all very much for coming forward. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 3347A. I'm going to carry the work session over on this bill till tomorrow. So we're going to carry over the work session for 3347A. I have one question I wanted to get answered, and we don't have enough time to do that today. So with that, Representative Olson, I have one other case. Do you have a I think your presentation with the video is going to take a little bit longer.
You know, honestly, we could probably pass on the video because it's on OLIS.
Okay.
That's your call.
Well, you think 5 to 10 minutes for your
probably. If it was that even, but
okay, we'll go ahead and open up the public hearing on House Bill 3365A.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, House Bill 3365A comes to this committee from Representative Olson, Taylor, and Springer. There's no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact. It passed out of the House 47-4. The bill modifies the crime of displaying obscene materials to minors, and it does three things. It changes the name of the offense. Secondly, it eliminates depictions of nudity from the list of obscene materials. And thirdly, it adds sex toys to the list of prohibited materials to those who are under the age of 14. The bill is ready to move.
Okay.
Okay, so Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is Andy Olson. I'm state representative out of the Albany area. And appreciate you taking this time, and I'll go through it quickly for you.
We've got time. I wasn't sure.
The video is 8 minutes long, and just a description of it. It was something that was done by Carla Castaño from KOIN 6TV, and she was alerted from a mom that had sent her a letter back in October last year, very concerned because she had dropped one of her kids off, a daughter that was 11 years old at the time, with some other kids, and they went through the Lloyd Center, happened to wander into Spencer's novelty shop. And in the process, later on, the mom finds this sex toy underneath her daughter's bed. So that kind of started the whole process. Carla Castaño calls me back in October, wanted to talk to me about it. She and another member from KOIN had gone into Spencer's at that location, had actually, with a hidden camera, captured about 10 minutes worth of film to show me. Now, that's what you're getting a chance to see on the video that's on OLIS now. And so it kind of gives you a lot better picture of what they were looking at, what we're concerned about. So what this bill does, the original bill was targeted toward minors. Having conversation afterwards with Michael Slauson, with Gail Meyer here, as well as Kimberly McCullough, we decided to, you know, move it down toward the child age of 14. It made more sense that way. And then that way they became neutral, and Department of Justice was there with us on it. Basically what the bill does is it kind of crafts and goes through, well, I'll just kind of look through the bill with you here. The first page identifies on line 7, so it's section 1, section 1, and then small b there on line 17, that a minor under 14 years of age who was not accompanied by the parent or lawful guardian of a minor to enter or remain on the premises, if in that part of the premises where the minor is so permitted to be, there is visibly displayed any instrument or device other than one primarily intended for a medical purpose, including contraception. Now, this is where the description of what they're prohibited from displaying, but then the following subsection also prohibits the purchase as well for the selling part. So the description is that specifically is designed to sexually stimulate a person's genital or anal areas as part of an act of sexual conduct. That's where we wanted to go with this, to at least prevent that from being displayed as well as being sold. Mr. Chair and committee members, you're aware that right now in adult shops, in contrast, age 18, that's where this law fits in, cannot go into an adult shop without showing some form of identification from what the owners show or request. There's nothing that prohibits this right now from a minor or a child from going into a novelty shop or any store from seeing some of this stuff. And that's where the video would really come in handy for you. So again, I would recommend for you all to take opportunity to take a look at that. What we're trying to do is just kind of close a loophole here a little bit and prevent that from being displayed as well as sold quite specific things. Now, the other thing that we did with the A and Gross, too, Mr. Chair, is that we also initially in the original bill, it was a 4-year statute of limitations. We reduced it back to the normal misdemeanor stage of 2 years, and that's kind of what that snapshot of the bill.
Okay. Senator Gelser.
Thank you. Question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Representative, what would happen in a place like Walgreens or Rite Aid? I read this bill, and I went to both a Walgreens and a Rite Aid, and they're just in the regular aisles. Would adults then have to go and ask a pharmacist to get something from behind the counter?
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Gelser, if they have, in fact, some type of a sex toy that's being displayed that is designed to sexually stimulate a person's genital or anal areas for part of a sexual conduct, yes. Well, I have not seen that. I mean, I've been in Walgreens. I have not seen that.
It's so right next to the pregnancy tests.
All right. They have vibrators and that type of thing right there in front?
Yep. Oh. And a follow-up? This isn't awkward.
This is
I reckon we're going to have to talk to Walgreens then,
right,
too.
Right. So just a quick follow-up, too. And I'm noticing the misdemeanor. Would a sister be guilty of a misdemeanor if her younger sister asked her questions about sexuality and that older sister showed her a vibrator or talked about one? Would she face a criminal penalty for having that conversation with her sister, or if a younger sister found that in her bedroom?
No. Mr. Chair and Senator Gelser, no, because we're talking specifically a premise where this stuff is displayed or sold from.
So it doesn't. So I'm looking in line 3 through 5. It says
on page 1.
On page 2, lines 3 through 5 is making obscene materials available to minors is a Class A misdemeanor. So that applies only to a store. So somebody could go and give a gift to a 13-year-old of one of these things, and that would not be a misdemeanor?
That's correct. Yeah, it wouldn't be a sister or family member. We actually tried to do something similar to that during the 07 session that we passed regarding furnishing pornography to a minor or to a child at that time. And then we had 2 court decisions, if you recall, that upheld that law, and then it went to the Ninth Circuit, and they found that it was unconstitutional.
Okay. And I guess I just don't understand, just because it's unconstitutional, that's why, because the plain language seems to be making obscene materials available. It doesn't say a store.
It does in Section 1, the first page.
Oh, okay, or being the owner, operator, or manager of a business.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Senator Gelser, again, if you take a look on the first page and look at the description specifically as it's designed for or remain on the premises, that's the key piece right there.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, any other questions? I think that takes care of it. All right.
You got to look at that video, Mr. Chair.
Well, we definitely will put that on the homework list for everyone.
And go to Walgreens, Representative Olson.
I will.
All right. Is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on House Bill 3365A? We're going to go ahead and close the public hearing, and we're going to open up our last of our public hearings for today, House Bill 2310A. Jeff?
Chair Brzezinski and members of the committee, House Bill 2310A comes to us from the House Interim Committee on Judiciary. The bill provides that the Department of Corrections must consider a lesser or greater included offense of a crime for which a sentence is imposed and any other crime in the same county designated as part of the same criminal episode when computing a sentence. It establishes that an incarcerated person receive credit for time served in jail after an arrest and before commencement of a probationary sentence. When probation is ordered as part of a downward dispositional departure, presumptive sentence, or as part of a diversion program or specialty court program where the defendant is not on probation. The bill provides that unless both the court expressly orders otherwise and the prosecuting attorney and defendant both provide consent, a person may not receive pre-sentence incarceration credit for time served in jail if a crime is not directly related to the crime for which the current sentence is being imposed, or for a violation of conditions of probation, parole, or post-prison supervision for which the crime is not directly related to the crime for which the sentence is being imposed. The bill allows a sentencing judge to limit credit for time served given to inmates sentenced on a downward dispositional departure. It allows sentencing proceedings occurring, it applies to sentencing proceedings occurring on or after the effective date of the act. It declares an emergency and is effective on passage. The bill is ready to move today, and we do not have any amendments before us.
All right, thank you. I've got Doug Harkleroad, Heidi Stewart, and Gail Meyer. Why don't y'all three come up? While they're coming up, will there be anyone else who wants to testify on House Bill 2310A? So, Heidi, I think I'm going to let you start off since this is for the Department of Correction. I think give you the framework and then we'll be able to.
Okay, sounds good. Thank you, Chair. Chair Przonski and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Heidi Stewart. I am Assistant Director with the Oregon Department of Corrections. And this bill is essentially what was described. It is a credit for time served bill that essentially applies credit for time served consistently. So right now what we have is if someone is charged with a crime, serves 6 months in a jail, and then is convicted of that same crime, they receive credit for time served for those 6 months that they were in jail. However, if someone is sitting in jail, they're charged with a crime, and then they're convicted of another crime, they don't get that credit for the 6 months that they were in jail. So we are in support of the bill, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
All right, let's go ahead and get the other testimony. Okay. And Doug, I think I'll ask you to go first. Gail, because I understand she's going to pull something.
Chair Przonski and members of the committee, my name is Doug Harkleroad. I'm the retired Lane County District Attorney. I'm the part-time executive director of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. I come to you today as the executive director of the District Attorneys Association to tell you that we support House Bill 2310 as engrossed as it sits in front of you today. This bill has a torturous path. It started in 2013 with a work group that Bill Taylor put together. And the Department of Corrections was there. The Oregon District Attorneys Association was there. I can't tell you whether or not OCDLA was in that original work group. Then nothing happened, and it moved forward to 2014, a bill called House Bill 4098. Wally Hicks, then Representative Hicks, was the sponsor of that bill. There were continuing negotiations about the bill. The Department of Corrections and the Oregon District Attorneys Association, we had several meetings, and I remember the last one where we finally agreed on what should be in this bill. Then the bill, in the short session, didn't move because it had a broad relating clause and other stuff got attached to it, as you're all familiar with. So it's now back in 2015 as House Bill 2310, and Representative Hicks then and now the elected county council came up on the House side and testified, and I reminded him of the old amendment, which he did remember, and which we basically asked Chair Barker to put into the bill, which he did. And so that's the tortured path. This bill says instead of one way to get credit for time served, there are six ways to get credit for time served. It's a significant expansion on credit for time served with a couple of sideboards. The old way was you do the crime, that burglary, you go to, you spend that 6 months in jail, and you get credit for it. If you did the burglary and then you got convicted of theft out of that, you didn't get any credit for that 6 months in jail. That didn't seem right, frankly, to myself or the Oregon District Attorney's Association. It's the same criminal episode. You should get credit. And that's on page one, where a lesser included or a greater included offense or the same criminal episode, you should get credit for time served for that, regardless of what you end up being convicted of. So that's kind of how it started out as a, and then it expanded. And it expanded to page 2, lines 12 through basically 20, whereas unless the court expressly orders otherwise, you don't get credit for time served on an indirect crime. That's the disorderly conduct over on the coast that has nothing to do with this burglary case here. And you spend 3 days in jail on the disorderly conduct. Nothing happens over there, but you've done 3 days. That's the indirect that is not directly related to the crime, the burglary for which you're being sentenced. And frankly, that doesn't make any sense to a number of us, that you should get credit for this completely unrelated thing. But we're okay with it if, in fact, the DA and the defense have to stipulate. Now, does that give the district attorney control? Sure. Or the municipal prosecutor or whatever control? Sure. But that's okay. We're actually only talking about Department of Corrections credit, so it's really felonies, okay? But they can get credit for the misdemeanors. There's also no time limit on this. So that disorderly conduct could have been 3 years ago where they did 3 days in jail. And that's okay with us, too, as long as we have some control. Now, what active prosecutors and defense attorneys know is that almost all of these cases are going to get resolved by a plea bargain. And so we're just going to factor in the credit for time served in here if there's another case that's brought to our attention in how the negotiation gets made. All right. So, and I think that's the area, I know that's the area that Ms. Myers is concerned about, because it gives the district attorney the basically control of that. And I don't disagree. It does give the district attorney control. I'd suggest there's good reasons, because in the old days, they got no credit for time served for the indirect. None. Okay. Then, towards the bottom here, there's three other ways you can get credit for time served that you didn't used to be able to get it. And that's on downward departures, our presumptive probationary sentences, and then on diversion programs. And I don't think we have any disagreements about that, so I'm not going to go through how all those work, okay? Anyway, I'd encourage you to move this bill just like it is. Thank you.
Thanks. Gail?
Thank you. Chair Barker, members of the committee, Gail Meyer, on behalf of the Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, we do think House Bill 2310 is a good and necessary bill. We have one suggestion as to how we think it might be more fair and balanced. We'd also like to belatedly acknowledge and thank former Representative Wally Hicks. He really took a big one on during the short session in 14. And there really was a big consensus work group, and I recall the bill moving out. And then it got to the Senate side and got very complicated over there. In the meantime, the district attorneys, and I believe DOJ, or DOC rather, sat down with Mr. Representative Hicks again and came up with some of these more limiting languages. The one that I would like to address is on Section 1, Subsection 4, Subparent B. Basically, this relates to when a person is confined on a crime that is not directly related to the crime for which the current sentence is imposed. This generally looks like different counties. So you might have charges in one county, and then those charges in one county impact your custody status on different charges in a separate county. County 1 may dismiss. You may get acquitted, but the time that you spent in custody in that County 1 definitely has impacted your custody status in County number 2. The way subsection 4 is written is the presumption is you're not going to get credit for time served there. We think that's the appropriate presumption. Then on line 12, as originally codified, it said, unless the court expressly orders otherwise. So there might be those instances when a court in County 2 would say, you know, you did 3 weeks in County 1, and it's impacted my your custody status in County 2. I'm going to give you credit for that. There may be instances when a court may make that decision. The district attorney's amendment that caught up was added in on lines 19 and 20. A court may enter that order only if the prosecuting attorney and the defendant agree to the order. So the net effect of this is, and our point is, the defense will always agree. We're talking about credit for time served here. The defendant is never not going to agree. So this essentially sets up a DA veto. And we just think it's more appropriate to leave it with the judge. We just think it's more appropriate to let the judge make the decision. So our proposal is, great bill, we propose removing subsection 4B on lines 19 and 20, and then you will leave that in the discretion of the court with the presumption that credit would not be provided, but in occasions it could be.
All right. I'm going to start with the question. So, Doug, I understand from the framework you said as to how things evolved in previous years and moved forward. So this amendment was discussed sometime in the past. Wally was asked to, if he remembered that. He says, yeah, I do. It's pulled off the shelf, and then it's put in. So I'm trying to figure out who were the players, who was involved in the negotiations at that time. I'm wondering, Gail, if you were there in the second part. I'm just trying to figure out who was participating.
Chair Przonski, here's my memory of how that all unfolded. There was a prior work group, and to be honest, I don't remember participating in it. I remember hearing about it. This was the Bill Taylor one back in
2013.
Okay. So then a bill came forward, and then in 14, Representative Hicks embraced it again, and there was a meeting with everyone there, DOC there, I think DOJ was there, DAs were there, we were there. And then I recall Representative Hicks's stated goal at the time was to be as broad as allowing credit for time served as could really be allowed. And so the bill then rolled out in its most broad version. What we were told, the OCDLA was told, as it was going to the Senate side, was subsequent to that initial rollout from the House side over to the Senate, the district attorneys had further conversations with Representative Hicks. I believe DOC was there, but we were not. We didn't really know that they were going on, and that there were these firmer, further limiting amendments that were agreed to. But in the meanwhile, the broader bill was hitting its own problems in the Senate side, and it all just dissipated. Yeah.
Okay. And then I guess this cycle, when it's on the House side, what discussions, if any, do we have regarding the amendment?
Chair Przonski, I'll give you my take on that. On the House side, the broader bill was introduced. And then I believe at the first, and Representative Hicks came to testify in support of it. And I recall at that point then the DAs resurrecting their amendment. And I do recall Representative Hicks saying, oh, yeah, no, I remember that, and I did agree to it.
Okay. All right.
Doug? Chair Przonski, if I might just add a little bit there. I saw this bill come through and before the hearing in House Judiciary. I said, oh, yeah, I remember this. And I grabbed the old amendment, which I had in my file. It was a draft amendment. It had never been put on OLUS. And I took it to Chair Barker and said, this was our deal with Wally Hicks. And so he agreed to move it into the bill, and we got the appropriate amendment to take care of that this time. So that's just, and then Wally did remember it when he showed up to testify.
Yeah. One more layer, Chair Przonski, is that on the House side, I remember articulating to Chair Barker that the limiting language had not been fully vetted and had a hearing and all that. And so Chair Barker said, I'm fine if you address this on the Senate side. I just want to move the bill and get it out. So,
gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you all very much. Jessica, I know. Thank you very much. That means you can leave. I've got one other person. Jessica, I understand you wanted to come on based on some of the hearing just to maybe give some clarification.
Yeah.
Thank you for coming up.
Thanks, Chair Przonski, members of the committee. Jessica Minifee from Legislative Council. From my memory and from the way this was explained to me from the Department of Corrections during the work groups in 2014, I think there's a misunderstanding as to what subsection 4 does on page 2.
Okay.
The original version of this statute is really talking about situations where somebody is in custody on two matters simultaneously. One would be a new crime, and the other would be a probation violation or parole or some other sentence that they're already serving. And what is happening now is, let's say you're arrested on a new crime, and at the same time, you're also put in custody on a probation violation. Prior to being sentenced on the new crime, you are sanctioned or sentenced on the probation violation. That means that you do not get any credit for time served on the new crime, even though you're in custody on that crime, up until the point that you're sentenced. And then from the sentencing on the new crime forward, you do get credit for time served. But for all that time that you were in custody before sentencing, technically you're serving a sentence on the probation matter, and you're not getting that credit. The other situation would be you're serving a sentence in the Department of Corrections, and you're brought to a county on a new crime. Again, because you're serving a sentence on another matter, when you're sentenced on the new crime, you're not getting that pretrial credit for time served until you're actually sentenced on the new crime. And so the way that this was supposed to read is just a clarification of current subsection 4. And I should say that the way that I'm explaining it now is how I remember DOC interpreting this section now. But the way this is supposed to work is that now a judge can give that credit, and it's discretionary. It wouldn't be automatic. Because right now the Department of Corrections cannot give that credit for time served. And so I tried to reflect that in the summary where I said that if the person is also serving a sentence on some other crime or probation violation, it could perhaps be clearer in the way that I drafted it on page 2 by inserting an also if the person is also confined as a result of a sentence for some other crime or violation. But we didn't want to change the language too much just because we knew what the current interpretation by the Department of Corrections was. As far as some completely unrelated crime that you might have done a few days in before being brought to another county, it's my understanding that Department of Corrections does not read this language as allowing them to do that. And I don't think that this would change anything. And that was one of many policy options that was discussed during the work groups and ultimately was not adopted as part of these amendments. So I just really want to be clear that that was what was going on back in 2014, and that was what this is supposed to address.
All right.
And I hope that's helpful.
I appreciate that. This is what I'm going to do. I'm going to close the public hearing. I'm going to ask the parties that have been here. I think we just have one more round table. Just to make certain, because I want to make certain everyone's on the same page based on the clarifications, that it follows through the intent and that discussion regarding what Gail Myers brought up. I think that's something y'all can talk about, and then we'll come back and we're going to, you know, my goal is to move the bill. The question is whether or not we have enough clarity in the bill as to what DLC wanted and interpretation, and it reads well, are sufficient to accomplish that. And you know, we can have this other little discussion as to the participants or who was or wasn't participating at that point when those other decisions were made. And we'll get this scheduled for a work session. What I'd like to do is try to have y'all get together if possible this week, and then we'll have this on for next week for a work session. We'll get it scheduled. The intent of, you know, from the chair and I think from the committee is to move the bill forward. It seems like it's got a lot of work and effort put into it. Let's just make sure all the T's are crossed and the I's are dotted. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2310A. And we will, as I say, carry that forward or get it reposted next week for a work session. We're just after 10. I'm wondering, committee members, we have some work session bills. Or do we have time to do those today, or do you want to carry them over?
I'm just going to bang, bang.
Yep.
So let's do it.
All right, we're going to go ahead and open up work sessions on three bills. First one's going to be House Bill 2356A.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, House Bill 2356A. We had a public hearing on this on May 11th. There is no revenue impact. There is a fiscal impact issued, and this bill does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. This is the bill that modifies the penalties for violations of the invasion of privacy statute to allow a C felony in two circumstances. One, for repeat offenders of the statute, and second, for those who record others when they are nude and in a place where they have an expectation of privacy. We have the proposed dash A9 amendment before the committee. That is a conflict amendment. It's a conflict amendment with House Bill 2356. In addition, the dash A9 amendment adds the invasion of privacy statute to the criminal code, as it is not currently in the criminal code. The bill is ready to move with the dash A9 amendment.
The A9s.
And it also, I should clarify, specifically removes, I'm just going to say, the upskirting provision, as that is in the other bill that we'll be addressing next.
All right.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash A9 amendment into House Bill 2356.
Senator Cruz moves the dash A9s into House Bill 2356A. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Chair, I move House Bill 2356A as amended by the A9 amendment to the fourth to pass recommendation and request a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Senator Cruz now moves House Bill 2356A as amended by the A9 amendments to the floor with the due pass recommendation with a request for a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Discussion? Any objections? So ordered. We'll close the work session on 2356A. Open up a work session on House Bill 2557A.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, House Bill 2557A came to this committee from Senators Gelser and Representative Greenlich. This bill has no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact. This is the bill that would allow those individuals found responsible or guilty except for insanity to seek expungement if the same offense would be expunged as a crime. The dash A3 amendment is before the committee. It does two things. One, it clarifies that records kept by the PSRB or the Oregon Health Authority do not need to be sealed or destroyed following a motion to set aside. In addition, it adds some clarifying language that was suggested by the Department of Justice at the last public hearing that we had to make it consistent with the criminal expungement statute. It is ready to move with the dash A3.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash A3 amendment into House Bill
2557. Senator Cruz moves the A3 in the House Bill 2557A. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2557A as amended by the dash A3 amendment to the floor with the new pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2557A as amended by the A3s to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion?
I bet I know who the carrier is going to be.
Any objection? And who is the carrier?
I would say the sponsor of the bill, I would think.
We'll go as Representative Senator Gelser?
Well, or as Senator Roblin continues to call her Representative Gelser.
Well, we'll go with Senator today, and she will be our carrier. All right, and we close that work session. We'll open a work session on 2596A.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, House Bill 2596A comes to this committee from Representatives Buckley, Olson, and Hack. There's no fiscal impact, no revenue impact. This is the bill that modifies the crime of invasion of personal privacy to prohibit the non-consensual recording of another person's intimate areas. There is one amendment before the committee, the dash A6 amendment, which is, again, a conflict amendment in response to the other bill we just moved, House Bill 2356. In addition, the amendment adds an emergency clause, and so this bill would take effect upon passage.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash A6 amendment into House Bill 2596.
Senator Cruz moves House the A6 amendment into House Bill 2596. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2596A as amended by the dash A amendments to the floor with the new pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2596A as amended by the A6 is to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objection? So order. The chair will carry that bill. We'll, we're going to close, but I just want to put on the record again, if I have this correct, House Bill 3347A as well as House Bill 3399A are being carried over tomorrow for possible work sessions. With that, oh, the last thing, Corey, as I mentioned, Senator Burdick was out ill, so she will be marked, please, as excused on the votes. Any other the order? Last thing we have is tomorrow. We're going to have a little bit of abbreviated time due to conflicts I have in the morning with the chair of the Judiciary Committee. So we'll be starting at 8:45 instead of 8:30, 8:45.
I might get Senator Burdick back with a
little. Yeah, see, that helps. All right, with that, we're adjourned. Thank you for staying over to get that work done.